Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is thriller novelist and entrepreneur, Joanna Penn. Good afternoon.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show. We're doing this from Denver to London. This is really cool.
Well, actually, I'm in Bath in the southwest. I used to be in London, but now I live out in the country, so it's a lovely summer day.
Well, you have an excellent connection. This is fabulous. So thank you for joining me on the show. So for those people who are not familiar with Joanna, she's a mystery and thriller novelist that I've been following on Twitter for quite some time. And I thought it'd be great to have her on the show to talk about her career and how she got to be such a successful writer. She's a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of thrillers under the name J.F. Penn. And she also writes inspirational nonfiction for authors. And she does consulting for people who want to become writers. So how did that all happen? I mean, how do you get to be a successful writer like that? It must be a fascinating journey. Did you always want to be a writer when you were little?
Well, I was one of those kids, you know, instead of dragging around a teddy bear when I was a toddler, I used to carry books around. So I was always a reader. And I think that's probably the number one thing for people who want to write is, you know, if you don't love reading, then just don't bother. but yeah, so I think because I read so much, I didn't really dream of being a writer because it felt like a really far away goal. But because I read so much, you know, when I just got, you know, fast forwarding a bit, when I got miserable with my life later on, I thought, what do I love most in the world? And I really love reading. I love reading. I love traveling. And I thought, well, if I write, then I can read and travel, and that will kind of be my job. So I didn't dream of it that early. The dream came a bit later on.
Who did you read when you were little? Did you read science fiction, or did you read mysteries, or did you read something completely different than you ended up writing about?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny you say that because I was a sort of Hardy Boys reader, the sort of action adventure books that I read when I was a kid. And then I have an action adventure series now. And I do have a mystery series too. And I did read Nancy Drew, you know, that type of thing. But I was always escaping in my mind and reading those sort of adventure books where people went around and solved things and found things and saved the world.
Sort of sounds like Stargate.
I guess a bit of sci-fi, but I'm not so much a sci-fi writer.
I saw on your list of books that are favorites that you're a big fan of Terry Brooks, and my wife is a big fan. I think she has everything that Terry Brooks has ever written.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, The Sword of Shannara and, you know, that series I certainly read when I was younger, but his book, Running with the Demon, has definitely shaped my writing because I always seem to have demons pop up in my books. So, you know, for some people that's fantasy, for some people that is, you know, a variety of religious experience, I guess, and for me it's a bit of supernatural, paranormal mystery. So, yeah, I think these early books sort of re-emerge in your writing. And another tip for people who are interested is always follow your curiosity, and the things that interest you will bond you with other people over time. You know, there are always people who love the things you love, even if what you love is quite weird. So I found that over the years that if I just kind of double down on the things I really love, that there will be people who are interested in that as well, and they're the people who enjoy my books.
Be fearless in being idiosyncratic, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, even to the point that I never used to share until a couple of years ago that I really like graveyards. And, you know, graveyards are one of those things. Like some people are like, oh my goodness, that's so weird. How could you like graveyards? And I love, like, when we go traveling, we visit graveyards and I like taking pictures of them. And, you know, I love all of that sort of imagery that you find there and the art and sculptures. And some people think that's weird. And then the people who like that and understand what I'm talking about, those people also, you know, might enjoy my books. So this is the thing. I think when you're honest about what you love and that's what you write about and that's what becomes entwined in your writing, you know, that's how you resonate with other people.
You have a very impressive background education-wise. You have a master's degree in theology from the University of Oxford, Mansfield College. And you have a graduate diploma in psychology. What is a graduate diploma in the UK? Is that like a doctorate?
No, it's actually it's from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. It's essentially what you do after. It's kind of instead of a master's, it's not a bachelor degree. It's a sort of equivalent. I was looking to do a postgraduate, go into becoming a clinical psychologist. It was like a conversion course. But after I did that, I decided that the job of being a psychologist was not as interesting as I thought it might be. So I thought, well, why don't I write about a psychologist? So Morgan Sierra in my books is actually a psychologist of religion. So I've kind of used both of those degrees, and I'm still fascinated. Like, I read a lot of psychology books, pop psychology, I guess, and I entwine that into my writing. But I am neither a theologian nor a psychologist.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because one of my favorite authors is also in the UK, I believe. His name is John Polkinghorne. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
John Polkinghorne is a theoretical physicist turned Anglican priest.
Ah, there
and
you
he's
go.
He's written a dozen books on the integration of science and religion. He's amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't see any issue with science and religion, you know, being next to each other in any way. I think they explain different things and serve different purposes. And, so I'm always interested in the science side and the question of is this faith, or is what's happening supernatural or a matter of faith, or is it just something that we haven't explained yet with science? I'm personally still, and this is another thing, I'm still a seeker in terms of my own beliefs. So every book I write, I'm kind of exploring the interesting things that happen on the edge of the supernatural. And some people call it one thing and other people call it something else. But I think, I believe there's something more than the physical. I just haven't got a particular name for that. But my books, I explore that edge of what is faith. And yeah, that really fascinates me as well.
Fascinating here too. I'm going to have to dig into these books because I think it's right up my alley. So were you, when you were studying theology, were you thinking about becoming a cleric perhaps?
Well, it's a bit of an amusing story in that I went to Oxford to study Arabic because I'd been working out in Israel and the West Bank as, sort of trying to work for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. This was way back in the 90s. So, obviously things are still difficult there and maybe they always will be. But I was very sort of committed to peace in the Middle East. So I went to do Arabic and my aim was to continue working in, civil service or something in a foreign office, go and do that. And then I got to Oxford and like my first day, they wrote all this Arabic on the blackboard as it was back then. And I was like, okay, I think this is a little bit ahead of where I am. And so I said to them, to the university, what else do you have? Because I'd already had a year off. I'd worked out in Israel my year off. And I was like, do you have anything else I could maybe do? Because I don't want another year off. And they said, oh, well, can you read ancient Greek? And as it happened, I did read ancient Greek. And
awesome.
And I said, well, yeah, I could do theology. What a great idea. So I joined, sort of moved over to theology. And actually, it's a fascinating degree. It's one of the oldest degrees in the world.
Let me ask you a question. Mm. Do you happen to have a copy of Erasmus' New Testament in Greek?
I don't have a copy anymore, but I did study it.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Very
yes,
nice.
We did. Reading, Revelation in ancient Greek is pretty fun. So I'm really, and the first book of my Arcane series, Stone of Fire, is about the bodies of the apostles and where they are around the world. The relics of the apostles, and also I look at obedience in fundamentalist religion, and these topics came out of my degree. So it's funny how we revisit these things from our earlier lives.
Oh yes. Oh yes. When I was younger, I was into astronomy and space, and ended up working for NASA. And funny how that kind of rolls around. I wrote some software at the beginning on an Apple II, and that ended up getting me a simulation job at White Sands. So, yeah, the things that you do and you love earlier in your career often do an encore performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And they give you ideas as well. And as things, some things change, some things stay the same. And these questions of, who we are and what we believe, these things will never change. I think they're part of the human condition. And, looking up to the stars and dreaming of what's out there, these things I don't think will ever change.
Well, with that, how did you end up being a business consultant, if I may ask?
Well, this is because I went to Oxford, and what happens, I'm sure it's the same at Yale and Harvard and all these top universities, is all these companies come around and try and recruit you. with debt, as everybody has leaving college, I took a job to pay that off, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And it was one of those decisions, and I'm sure many people can, resonate with it, that you make a decision that you think won't last very long, because you think, oh, I'll just do this for a few years and then I'll do what I really want to do. And I actually ended up being a business consultant for 13 years, implementing accounts payable into large corporates, which is deathly boring.
In software
in software. In software. So I was in SAP.
Oh, I'm sure. Cool. Oh, yes. We all know about SAP, all of us in the Apple world.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, I was an SAP consultant, highly paid. I traveled a lot, worked all over Asia Pacific and Europe. And so it was a great job from many perspectives, but I was just miserable. And I talk about existential pain because I was not in physical pain. I had a nice life, and were paid well and, like these big companies are, but it ends up being a sort of cubicle slave type situation. Mm-hmm. And I just was like,
life.
Yeah. And it was, what am I doing with my life? I do believe that the end of our life is the end of our life. And it's like, well, what, this is really pointless. I just do the same thing, with software, right? You put in some software and 18 months later, someone decides that they're going to implement some new software. So everything you do disappears. And that's what I really felt, is that everything I do disappears when they put in this new overwritten software or new upgrade, and it's just pointless. So what can I do that brings more meaning to my life, helps other people.
Create a body of work.
Yeah, create a body of work, exactly. And also be creative and be happier than I am. So that was that's what I ended up doing for 13 years, but it was not what I thought I would ever do. And luckily now I don't do it. I left in 2011.
How did you make the break? Did you start writing novels in the evening on an experimental basis? Or did you just walk in one day and say, I quit, and take your money and go write?
Yeah, so I tried quitting a number of times, as many people do in this situation. And I, left and traveled and did other things and always went back because the money was so good. And and that just gets worse. Once you've done something for 8 to 10 years, you become quite valuable, right? So I kept going back, but I was like, do you know what? I'm coming up to, what was I, early 30s. It was like, this is crazy. I have to get out. So I started writing, but I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So I started writing a book, which I later rewrote. It's called Career Change. And essentially, I wanted to know what to do in my life. So it's a kind of self-help book that I wrote for myself. And in writing that book, I realized that I enjoyed writing. And I self-published it. So I started learning the publishing industry. I marketed it myself. So I learned about marketing and the internet and all of this type of stuff. So I started that in 2007, and I wrote that book, started my site, The Creative Pen, and then I got into writing novels.
Did you get an agent, or did you just approach a publisher and get him to buy that book, and how did that work?
No, I'm a businesswoman and someone who does not like to ask permission. So I've chosen always to be an independent author. So I have my own limited company. I publish myself and I take 70% of royalties instead of 10%. So I publish as a creative entrepreneur, basically.
Did you sell your first novel that way?
I sell directly to customers. So I'm on Amazon and I've got print books and ebooks and audiobooks. So basically you don't need a publisher to sell to customers anymore.
Yeah, but you sort of got to rise above the noise and get people to know about you. You have a beautiful website. That's probably part of it.
Thank you. Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, the reality of the publishing industry now is the author does the marketing anyway. So I've just learned about marketing over the years. And of course, I have 20 books out. So once you have a number of books out, then, you know, that helps. But yeah, I mean, I think to be an entrepreneurial creative these days, to be a successful creative and make what we would call decent money, is to take control of your creative career. And luckily, I love all of it. So being a business consultant for years definitely helped in turning creative.
Now, we have a bit of an Apple-centric audience here. So I'll ask you, do you use a Mac? I'm hoping, crossing my fingers.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Absolutely.
And let me ask another question.
Yes.
Everybody I've interviewed and all the people I follow and all the Mac writers and the people who are in tech, they all have cats. I haven't run across an author yet who has a dog. Dogs bark. They're high maintenance. You can't travel. I'm betting if you have a pet, it's a cat.
And yeah, we did have a cat.
Bingo. I win.
No, we are definitely cat people. And when we left Australia, our cat was a bit feral. And so instead of putting him in a box for 24 hours, we decided to find him a home. So, but no, as soon as we decide where we're going to live, we'll get another cat. But because we move around a lot, I didn't want to do that. But I really miss our cat.
So did you grow up in Australia?
No. I left England in the year 2000, went backpacking, and then ended up staying in New Zealand for 7 years and then Australia for 4 years and before moving back.
I bet you love New Zealand. My wife has been to New Zealand many times because she was with the U.S. Antarctic Program. So you go through New Zealand
fantastic.
To get to the Antarctic.
Yeah, New Zealand's
an awesome
fantastic
country.
Yeah, fantastic. My husband's a Kiwi, so we go back quite a lot.
Okay. So MacBook Pro, right?
Yeah, I have a MacBook Pro, and I basically, what's so brilliant about the lifestyle and the my business, I basically run my multinational business from my laptop. So yeah, I have a MacBook Pro, I have an iPhone.
I hope you have
I still have an iPod.
Time machine backup and a carbon copy cloner backup.
Yeah, I have the whole works. And I think there's also something like when I became an author, it was like, I have to get off the PC. It was almost like, you know, to be a creator, you must have a Mac.
Now, do you use a one of those really cool authoring programs like Scrivener or Ulysses?
Yes, I am a Scrivener user.
Oh, it's my favorite app.
Oh, it's amazing. And Scrivener will change your life. And
yes, it will.
Did you know it's now out on the iPhone and the iPad?
Yes.
So there we go. So I have that. Although I still use it just on the Mac. But if people don't know Scrivener, I wrote my first novel on Word or Pages.
That must have been painful.
It was super painful. But Scrivener, you know, you drag and drop things. You don't have to write in order. Also, for people who might not know, you can output the files you use to publish ebooks. Output my Kindle file,
EPUB.
Upload it to Amazon. Yeah, output my EPUB, upload that to Apple, and there you go. And I publish directly on Apple as well. You can publish on iBooks, just like you publish a podcast through iTunes. So, yeah, it's in my whole ecosystem, my whole publishing business is from the MacBook Pro.
Awesome. How about that, listeners? Well, let's take a short break right now. We'll be right back in 60 seconds. I want to hear from Kelly, and Kelly's going to tell us about how you can help out the Mac Observer. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thank you, Kelly. We are speaking with Joanna Penn, thriller novelist. So I wanted to ask you about your favorite authors when you were young. We touched on it a little bit on the first segment, but I know you're a big Stephen King fan. Did you find that you fixated on a particular author who you wanted to write just like? I know in my case, my favorite writer of all time, aside from a couple science fiction writers, is John D. MacDonald and his Travis McGee character. And I thought, oh, if I was ever going to do anything, I was going to do something just like that. Or did you kind of just read everything and it sort of mishmashed and then came out in your own style?
Yeah, well, I think the author that changed my life, I mean, he's not really my favorite author, but it would be Dan Brown, in that when The Da Vinci Code came out, you know, that was the moment when I thought, do you know what? People like religious thrillers. so that really influenced me. And
well, that's usually what happens when you go to a publisher. You say, oh, I have this great story about living in Jamaica, you know, and the author goes, well, the publisher says, nobody's buying those books. So what we'd really like you to do is write a book about this, because those will really sell. And you go, and you groan and go, oh, I don't want to write that.
Well, luckily being independent means I can write what I love.
That's right, that's right.
But what I realized then, and you know, people think those types of thrillers might have gone off the boil, but, you know, I've met Steve Berry and I know that they're not. And James Rollins would be another one. You know, the kind of action adventure novels that also have a religious puzzle or a supernatural angle. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Stephen King, The Stand was probably the first book I read and went, oh my goodness, this is brilliant. I mean, similar to Terry Brooks, I think Stephen King's books are sort of good versus evil at a much deeper level. You know, on a human level, but also a supernatural level. And that's kind of the underlying, what I tackle in all of my books, is that good versus evil. And, you know, I recently read Du Marquis, Stephen King's. And again, it's a sort of good versus evil in the world. And so that's what I love. And I also love Stephen King for the fact that he was kind of ridiculed for a long time as just a pulp writer. And now, you know, he's kind of a modern classic. You know, he wins awards. He's considered, you know, not literature, but the fact is he's he's one of the most loved writers by readers around the world. And he wins awards because eventually the establishment went, oh, okay, a horror writer can be really well loved. You know, you don't have to write, win the Pulitzer Prize or whatever. And also from an entrepreneurial perspective, he's been very successful. He's got, you know, film deals. He's makes multi-million dollars. So if you're going to have a favorite author as an author and you're an ambitious person like me, mm-hmm. having someone who is both an amazing writer and is well loved by readers and who is very, very successful. So that's, I guess, why I sort of put him on a bit of a pedestal. And, you know, hopefully I'll never meet him because I'll just collapse in a puddle. But I think that is very good.
Just grab him and kissing.
Yeah, exactly. But I certainly think, and also I think the fact that he's in his 60s now, I'm in my early 40s, and I think, do you know what? If I create my body of work over the next 20 years, I could be in a position that someone like Stephen King is. But the only way to do that is to keep writing books and to keep becoming a better writer. So that's what drives me, really, you know, is building my craft.
They say it takes years and years and years to be an overnight success.
Yeah, exactly. And I started writing the first nonfiction book 10 years ago. And, you know, my first fiction was 2011. So, you know, check in with me 2021 and we'll see how things are going. But, you know, it's just a matter of becoming a better writer, I think.
I wanted to ask you about your travel. How do you use, I'm curious about this, how do you use your travels, which you do a lot, to inspire you? I mean, what is the mechanism there? Is it seeing different places? Is it a feeling of a sense of history? Is it meeting new people? Is it inspiration for a new locale for your adventure series? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a lot of the resonance of the place. So, for example, Israel. I love Israel. I've been a lot. I'm just actually going back in a couple of months' time. And that comes through in a lot of my books. And that is, you know, obviously historical, religious. It's an incredibly powerful place, and Jerusalem in particular. I first went to Israel when I was 15. And I think that really has shaped my writing a lot. So since then, obviously, I've traveled a load of places in the world. And I just tend to, again, follow my curiosity. So I'll do, I will go on specific tours. You know, I will seek out the interesting places. So for example, we went to Budapest, and although it's a very kind of dark story, the rise of the far right, in Budapest and Hungary, you know, we went to, the places where the communists held people. We went to the sort of where the Nazis held the Jews, and, you know, places that resonate with history are places that I feel story. So yeah, I don't so much talk to people because I'm an introvert like many authors. I prefer not to talk to people apart from on podcasts, obviously. But when I go to these places, this is where the iPhone comes in very handy, because I take a lot of pictures. So I'll take pictures of art and architecture and places and, you know, things I want to remember. And I have Pinterest boards. So I'm sure people know Pinterest. I think I'm pinterest.com/JFPen. And I have a Pinterest board per book. And I put my photos there and, you know, of my travels and the things I see. And then when I'm writing the book that's come out of that, that situation and that place, I will go back to those pictures, and they will often provide the reality behind the fiction. So there's a lot of authenticity. Most of the places in my books I've been to, although, for example, Iran, I haven't been to Iran, and that's in Stone of Fire. But most places I have actually been to.
Cool. A lot of us who are technical writers in the Mac and the PC web, people who write about technology, many of us have this sort of like bee in our bonnet that, boy, really would be cool to write a novel, to be a science fiction writer or a mystery writer or a thriller writer or something like that. Have you run across many people like that, and do they make the transition easily? Is this something that, because you're already a technical writer, is a natural thing to do, or do you find in your experience that it's a big leap to fiction, even if you're a writer?
Yeah, I made that leap myself, and it was very hard. I mean, I literally, you know, wind it back 10 years. I did not think I was creative. I did not have any ideas. I was writing, you know, technical specifications for SAP interfaces with banking systems. Mm-hmm. You know, I was doing really technical writing, you know, down to the individual codes and all of that type of thing, and working with programmers. So, and at that point in my life, I couldn't even imagine writing fiction. And the process of becoming creative, in inverted commas, because of course we all are, it's a bit like a muscle. It's about, you know, like you go to the gym, you have to start slowly and work up to it, because of course now at this point I have so many ideas I don't know what to do with them all. So how I started doing this, if people want to do it, is I started listening to what I was interested in. So coming back to that again, and putting myself in situations where I would be able to find things I was interested in. So
and the travel rolled into that, right?
Yeah, travel does. But even I realize a lot of people can't do that. So even going to like an art gallery, or going to, you know, or even online, even if you can't, you know, go to an art gallery, for example, if you live in the middle of nowhere, go to Pinterest. But I think I find Pinterest, I'm a very visual person, and have a look, you know, like enter something that you're interested in and see, like the color brown. Let's just pick brown, which is not a very inspiring color, right? Generally for most people. But if you put in a color on Pinterest, a whole load of images will come up. Now, the thing then to do is to listen to what your mind says. So, for example, if there's some wood, that a wooden chair, who sits on that chair? You know, just start asking questions about the things you see. And I think that's all it comes down to. It's asking questions about the things, the places you're in, the people you talk to. You know, why did they say that? You know, why are you interested in space and it's not something I'm interested in? You know, why am I fascinated with demons? You know, what does a demon look like? You know, you just follow this sort of, you know, web, and what you'll find is, and then you start writing these things down. So I use, again, back to the iPhone, I use Things app, which is on the Mac, desktop and mobile, which means I can sync it everywhere. It also syncs to the cloud. So all my ideas I keep on the Things app under a, you know, ideas tab, and I just log everything. It might be a link that I come across on the web. It might be a picture. It might be just a quote. It might be something I saw. And I have thousands of these little one-liners. And then when it comes to you know, learning the craft, you know, that's a kind of more technical thing, almost learning the craft, but then turning those ideas into a book is much easier when you have a load of ideas. But I think a lot of technical writers think that they don't have an idea for fiction. So does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you, have you ever had a sense of place when you walk into an ancient building or a castle or an old church? I was in a bank one time in Colorado that was turned into a museum. Old wooden floors and dusty ceiling fans and dark. And I walked in there and I didn't see the museum. I felt the sense of past, and I had this flash of when it was a bank and people walking into the bank and doing things. And I was at Estes Park, and there was this Marine Visitor Center where they have these exhibits. But it used to be a kind of a congregation getaway resort where people came up and stayed, a lodge. And I wasn't looking so much at the exhibits about the rock formations as I was feeling the sense of history. And I was looking upstairs where there was a loft, and the fellow said, yeah, people used to come up here. And I told one of the rangers, and I said, yeah, I can kind of feel like, you know, I can see Jimmy Stewart sitting in a rocking chair up there with a blanket in his lap. So have you ever had that happen to you in your travels?
Yeah, and that's, it's interesting because that is what drives my writing. So a lot of people don't feel that. And that means if you were to write fiction, it would have a very strong sense of setting, as my books do. Whereas other people don't find setting so inspiring. So again, Stephen King definitely does setting. Du Marquis is amazing in terms of setting the island as an entity, really. But yeah, that setting, I mean, have you been to Jerusalem?
No, I haven't. Nope.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, that place is just... you know, you just feel it. You realize
right.
why it's so fought over.
It probably reverberates in your head for years.
Yeah, it does. It kind of haunts you. And it's the type of place, like, I feel almost addicted to wanting to go back there because of that sense of place. And there are some places in the world that are very powerful, and that is one of them. I think also, like, quite a different place, but the Grand Canyon, having been there, and where some of the Hopi people have their... you know, spiritual places around the Grand Canyon. I felt very much that place was very powerful in many ways, you know, and very different to somewhere like Jerusalem, which is man-made, as opposed to whether you think created or from, you know, the world. It's a pretty powerful place. So I think, yeah, being sensitive to the history and the resonance of places can come through very much in your writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, because people often write about places in nonfiction too.
Cool. Do you outline your novels for the sake of, you know, coherence and continuity? Do you sort of, like, you know, fill in a synopsis for each chapter and what you want to achieve and then fill in the blanks? Or do you just flow stream of consciousness, like...
Yeah, I don't think anyone does that, really. Lee Child says he does with Jack Reacher, but, you know, no, I am, because I have quite complicated plots, I do some plotting, but I mainly use Scrivener. So I don't have like a separate document. I just put things into Scrivener, and there's lots of research areas and different places you can put information that's not the writing itself. So I tend to know my opening scene and my final scene, and then I just use Scrivener to sort of plot a little bit, but I don't do I know some people do spreadsheets and stuff. I don't go that far, but some people do.
I remember my first reading of The Martian.
Oh, yes. Great book. Yeah.
And I thought, after I read the first page or two, I thought, this is the best opening of any science fiction novel I've ever read.
Yeah. I mean, of course, The Martian. Yeah, well, The Martian was originally self-published. He put it out on his blog, and then he put it on Amazon, and then from there got a film deal, and then went on to sell it to a publisher. So, you know, and he's born, The Martian is born out of a love for space, right, and tech and everything. So it's a real great example of someone who just followed what they were curious with.
But he also knew how to grab the reader at the beginning.
Well, that's really editing. Don't ever think that people start writing the first sentence and it's amazing.
I've read so many books in a bookstore where I picked up a book and I read the first page and I thought, oh, I'm not going to read the rest of this book. If he can't grab me or she can't grab me in the first page, You know, there's no hope for this. But there are other books where I go, oh, this is a page turner. Robert B. Parker is like that. The reason I like Robert B. Parker, he's not with us anymore. He's written a lot of cool mystery books, especially the Jesse Stone series. And he keeps his chapters really short. And I ever thought, and I've read authors who have, you know, 40-page chapters. And there's some psychology there, for me at least, that when I get to the end of a 2 or 2.5 page chapter, it's so easy to go, oh, I'm going to read one more, because it's like a page turner. I want to find out what's going on.
Yeah, it's a potato chip. But, and that is a James Patterson thing, too.
Yeah.
And it is very much a genre separation. Like, a lot of literary novels will have a lot longer chapters. So a lot of those things are sort of publishing norms, I guess. And what I like about what you're saying about the books you pick up and like and the books I pick up and like, you know, that's why there's always room for more books in the world, because everybody likes different books. So, and everyone who writes a book reads a ton more books than they will ever write. So I want everyone in the world to write books.
That's right. Before we close, we're just about running out of time. I wanted to ask you about something I ran across a while back in my own writing. I referred to a Washington Post story where they were using artificial intelligence agents, which they concocted to generate news for the Rio Olympics. And the idea was to, you know, go out to the news feeds and grab information and be able to post quick news items to Twitter, for example, and free up the real writers, the human writers, to do things that were more important. And then as I researched that, I discovered another story about a computer research program where somebody had a computer program actually write a novel a few years ago with mixed results. And as I look at the computer industry and I look at all the emphasis nowadays on artificial intelligence agents, you know, chatbots, Cortana and Siri, we're getting to the point where computers are going to start talking to us and relating to us, passing the Turing test more and more often, being able to understand human psychology through vast readings of its own. You know, Watson reads 12 million pages of medical journals in not much time at all in order to do oncology analysis. So when computers start reading a lot of fiction, perhaps there'll be a day when computers can start writing a lot of fiction that relates to humans in a human way. And a lot of people think that can't happen because there's going to be some missing human element in the computer. And some people think we can instill that into the computer, just like we can instill chess strategies into computers. What do you think about the future of computers doing more and more fiction writing?
Yeah, well, firstly, I am a futurist and I love tech, so I'm totally into this and looking forward to more AI. But also, this has already happened. So March 23rd, 2016, a Japanese AI program made it to the finals of a literary prize in Japan. So basically, it got past all the sort of people who wouldn't believe that and made it into the finals. Didn't win, but that obviously means at some point it might. So I absolutely agree with you that, yes, AIs will be able to write books. And in fact, they possibly already are. And they're probably writing nonfiction and they will write fiction. So, but what I think is the thing for people to remember is that's not necessarily a bad thing. Also, I think that we've seen with chess, I think it was Kasparov, who showed that an AI with a human will outperform just an AI or just a human. So what we'll be using AI for is as a tool to do things better. And there are loads of things that as a writer I would love an AI to do for me in terms of, you know, research, or, you know, if I put this with this, what would this create? How could I? In fact, there's I wanted to refer people to a thing called Ostagram, which is a sort of art technique where done with neural networks, where you put two pictures into this program and it combines the two pictures into something original from those two pictures. And I see this as a visual example of something that I will do when I have an AI to help me write. And I will create something that neither of us could do alone, but together we produce something even more amazing. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Interesting perspective. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you could actually task the AI agent to go out and write a couple of passages about, for example, that you think are essential, but you don't want to write yourself. You want to focus on something else.
Yeah, I want to focus on creating. I mean, one of the things that might, you know, that is helping is the dictation stuff. So I use Dragon Dictate on the Mac, for example, mm-hmm. and it's not perfect. You know, I would love to be able to work with an AI to make my dictation and my creation a much easier process. One thing I would say is that I think personal brand and author brand will become much more important, and already is. Like, you know you're talking to a human. I hope you know I'm human. But if we were doing this on video, you would see that I'm human until we get to the point where AIs look like humans. But I think this personal brand around your creations is super important. So like I've said, I love Stephen King. Hopefully people will say, I love J.F. Penn, and will know that even though when I create with an AI, that's what they will be looking for. So I'm really looking forward to when we have AI and more virtual reality and augmented reality, because I intend to use it as a creative to create more in the world. So I think we're living in such an exciting time.
That's an inspiring perspective, because a lot of people to first order are rather dour about it and say, well, you know, the last bastion is going to be gone and all of our fiction is going to be written by computers. And so I think you have a great forward-looking perspective about how AI agents can marry with humans. That's awesome.
Oh, good.
I've never heard that before.
Oh, good. And I fully expect to be having my book launches in virtual reality, you know, like come meet me in virtual Jerusalem for my next book launch. So watch out for that in probably 5 years' time.
Cool. This has been an amazing adventure. Thanks for telling us about your journey. And thanks for sharing these episodes with us. Joanna, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you for sharing them with us and telling us all these interesting things about being a writer. It's been cool. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Yeah, sure. So all my fiction is at jfpen.com, and that's J and then F for Francis. Or all my books are on all the places you buy books online. And also, if you're interested in writing, my site, thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N, has loads more information and a podcast. And I'm on Twitter at thecreativepen if you have any questions.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks again, Joanna. It's been delightful. And listeners, really appreciate you coming by. Hope you had a good time listening to us. And we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.